Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
My name is Chris Ansell, and I am chair of the Charles and Louise Travers Department of Political Science here at Berkeley. And it is my pleasure to welcome you to the 22nd, I emphasize 22nd, annual Travers Conference on Ethics and Accountability in Government. The Travers Conference is an annual public affairs conference started by Colonel Charles Travers, who met his wife Louise here at Cal in 1930, where both of them were political science majors. We're very tickled by that. We don't know how many other budding romances there are in the department at the moment, but anyway. Together they became generous long-term supporters of Berkeley's academic and athletic programs, a tradition carried on by their children, their grandchildren, and even their great-grandchildren. One of the issues that greatly concerned Charles Travers was the quality and integrity of our political system, and particularly the challenge of ensuring ethical and accountable government. And so he endowed an annual conference, among other things, that would publicly explore the major political issues of the day. The Travers Conference on Ethics and Accountability in Government has been a signature element of our department's annual programming, providing valuable opportunities for both students and the wider community to hear from thought leaders from the academy, journalism, government, and industry. For over two decades, the conference has taken up a wide range of important topics related to politics and governance, everything from California's energy future to the problem of money in politics. The Travers program has never shrunk from dealing with big and difficult issues, which brings me to the theme of today's conference, is America breaking apart? You can't get much bigger than that, I don't think. Frankly, it feels a little scary to me to even be asking that question, but it's meant to be provocative. I think most of us have wondered how the country has become so socially and ideologically divided. It feels like the norms of civility and mutual respect have all but disappeared, and that we live in a world of warring camps that see politics as a blood sport. And if that's true, what does that say about our ability to govern and about the cohesion of our nation? It's important, however, I think, not to take these issues at face value, because a lot is at stake here. Are we really, in fact, as socially and ideologically divided as it feels like we are? Maybe the public isn't really deeply divided at all. Maybe the divisiveness we experience is really just a reflection of aggressive campaign tactics or Fox News and CNN vying for viewers every night. Possibly we also need to turn the question around and ask not what divides us but what unites us. What do we share? Does the young urban hipster from Oakland share anything with the middle-aged farmer from Nebraska? Even though we're divided in important ways, maybe we're united in even more fundamental ways. Maybe our sense of nationalism, our sense of being Americans, is more important than what separates us. But if the divisions are fundamental, what is it that really divides us? Is it ideology, class, religion, generation, race, geography, or is it really some combination of all those things? And if our nation is as deeply divided as many of us fear, what should we do about it? That's the hard question. But one answer is do nothing. Maybe this is just the new normal, and our democratic institutions are strong enough to manage those differences. Maybe the young hipster in Oakland and the middle-aged farmer from Nebraska don't need to share much, because we have a federal system that does a pretty good job of dealing with our diversity. But maybe this optimistic view is wrong. Instead, maybe we're one or two constitutional crises away from a really significant erosion of our democratic order. The pessimistic scenario is that our differences have the potential to tear us apart. And if that's the case, we really need to know how we can address our differences in a more fruitful way. How can we improve our ability to engage in constructive dialogue? How can our political parties work together in a less conflictual manner? How can we mend the racial and ideological divisions that threaten to pull us apart? As you can see, I'm providing more questions than answers. That's a good way to start a conference, I think. But that's why we've brought together a really incredible group of scholars from around the country. Their charge is to illuminate these issues for us and address the theme of the conference, Is America Breaking Apart? Well, since we all know that academics are the model of decorum and civility, I don't expect the conference anyway to break apart, or I don't think it will. But I do expect that them to offer us some provocative perspectives on these topics. And I want to sincerely thank them for coming from all over to be part of this and contributing their time and energy. So thanks very much. A public affairs conference cannot by itself mend all our fences. But what it can do, I think, at best, is to help us diagnose our public problems. It can offer different perspectives on issues. It can make relevant and important information more widely available. And it can encourage a healthy public dialogue. And so in its own way, the annual Travers Conference is a kind of antidote to what ails us in contemporary politics. It's an attempt to nurture a civic dialogue that gets beyond superficial point scoring. In fact, it's been doing that successfully for 21 years, and I hope it'll do it for many years to come. So I want to end by thanking the Travers family, led by Chuck and Beth Travers, and Todd and Gail Travers, who are sitting over here at this table. Thank them very much for bringing us this conference and for all the great things that they do for the Charles and Louise Travers Department of Political Science. Give them a hand, if you will. And thanks, finally, to all of you for coming out. This is a great audience. We're very delighted to have everybody here. So thank you very much. We're looking forward to a terrific conference. And I think I'm next supposed to pass it off to Rob Van Howling, who's going to introduce the first panel.
Thanks, Chris, for introducing the conference. So it's great to have all of you here. So I'm going to introduce our panel, and then each panelist will come up, give their presentation, and then after that, they'll each talk for about 15 minutes. Then after that, you'll have an opportunity to ask questions of them. They'll sit up here and we'll do that, but we'll first have them each come up independently and give a presentation. The first panel of the day is titled Divisions in the Public, Imagined or Real? And while there's little doubt that political elites in the United States, office holders, et cetera, are highly polarized by party, there's a question as to what extent, and Chris alluded to this, Americans more generally are ideologically polarized. And this panel is going to consider the extent from in various aspects of the extent to which people are themselves polarized by policy preferences, partisanship, and geography. So that's going to be the focus of this first panel of the day. I want to introduce the first person on this first panel right now. That's going to be Morris Fiorina, or Mo Fiorina. Mo is the Wendt Family Professor of Political Science at Stanford University, and he's also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's published numerous articles and books, a number of which have become central in different ways to our understanding of representation in the United States. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the National Academy of Sciences. I'd say for the past decade or so, his work has focused almost directly on the central question of this conference, whether America is breaking apart. And this includes his most recent book, Unstable Majorities, Polarization, Partisan Sorting, and Political Stalemate. I encourage you to buy that most recent book. With that, I'll hand it off to Mo, who is a perfect person to start us off for the day.
Thank you to the Travers family for hosting this conference, and thank you all for coming. When Rob asked me to speak on the topic today, I said sure, because almost 2 years ago, I was asked to speak on virtually the same topic. The only difference there was they gave me a half hour, so I had to cut this, the second half of this talk off, update a few slides. So that's what you get today. We tend to forget that in less than two decades ago, we wouldn't have been asking a question like this. In the 2000 election, George Bush ran as a compassionate conservative. We had a budget surplus. Liberal democracy had triumphed around the world. The world was extremely different. And then came a variety of things. And by 2004, we had a very different narrative describing American politics. There was a culture war, a virtual civil war. And the interpretation here, if you're in a red state, was the God-fearing, hardworking people of the red states or allied against the godless libertines of the East and West Coasts and the old socialists in the upper Midwest. And if you were in California, you might have seen it somewhat differently. Yeah. This narrative of division has been with us ever since. It went down a little during the early Obama administration, but then resurged. And after the last election, here are some of the titles of commentaries written. The Abbas. Civil war is a very common metaphor. Fascism. We're doomed. And the claim here is that we have divided into two camps. Center is diminished. A couple of lumps. And insofar as public opinion is concerned, that is wrong. It's true when we look at public, high-level public officials, donors, activists, etc. This is the House of Representatives John Kennedy faced in 1961. Democratic representatives are outlined in blue, Republicans in red. This is based on scaling their roll call votes. As you can see, it's sort of clumped toward the center. There are about as many Democrats as Republicans right in the middle. Here's what the House looked like when Barack Obama took office. There we go. As you can see, the Democrats have shed their more conservative wing. Republicans have moved far to the right. There's now no overlap. The most liberal Republican is to the right of the most conservative Democrat. And as I say, that sort of thing is true in places like California, in the legislature, in New York, et cetera, donors, activists, and so forth. But is it true of the mass public, ordinary Americans out there? How would political scientists study that? Well, we've done it in various ways. If we look at the ideological distribution of the public, would we find that over time the moderates all went away and became either liberals or conservatives? If we were focusing on particular issues like, say, abortion, which divides the party, would we find that people who were in the middle, wishy-washy, had all become either pro-choice or pro-life? If we looked at partisanship, would we find that independents had all become either Democrats or Republicans? And the fact is, in none of these ways do the data support anything like this. That here is the ideological distribution of the public from the General Social Survey data. It looks the same today as it did in Jimmy Carter's era. Moderates are about 40% of the electorate, liberals about a little under 20, conservatives a little over 30. It fluctuates, but there's basically no change. Look at something, a specific issue like abortion. The Republican platform is never, no exceptions. About 20% of the public agrees with that. Democratic platform is anytime, any reason. About 30% of the public agrees with that. And the plurality or majority of the public says sometimes for some reasons. Now, neither party offers them that option, which I'll come back to a little later. And again, fluctuation, but no real trend over time. On issue after issue, we see the same thing, that people clump toward the middle. So, for example, this is healthcare. These are the people, about 13%, who favor single payer. These are the people, about 13% over here, who favor leaving everything to the private sector. As you can see, on issue after issue, people clump in the center. Partisanship, the story is even worse for the polarization narrative. Republicans had never even managed to get back to where they were with the Eisenhower era. Democrats have been steadily losing ground and are now almost even with Republicans. And independents are the big growth category. And there are a number of books written on this that I'll mention. What has happened in the U.S., which gives us this impression of tremendous division, is what we call party sorting, which has led to party polarization. That when I was a young man, which was a long time ago, the Democrats had a conservative wing. The Republicans had a liberal wing. Today, the Democrats have shed that wing. The liberals have shed their liberal wing. If you were a liberal, you were a Democrat almost certainly. If you were a Republican, you were a conservative almost certainly. So the underlying distributions haven't changed. It's just they've sorted out that things are correlated now in a way they weren't a generation or two ago. And there are three features of this process that we know about. The first is it's top-down, and I use the example of abortion because it divides the parties at the top so clearly. The party platforms began to diverge in 1976. It wasn't until 1992 that a randomly chosen Democrat and Republican in the population differed on this issue. It took 16 years for it to percolate down. It increases with political involvement, that is, activists and officials are more sorted than the ordinary people, and it's far from perfect among ordinary voters. So, for example, back in 1980, these are Republicans and Democrats, the difference between, on this item, always is a matter of a woman's personal choice. And back in 1980, there's almost no difference. Now, gradually over time, they're sorting out. So these are the donors and activists. They're about 10 to 15% of the electorate. These are the strong partisans, the primary voters, there are fewer, and these are the weak partisans. And so you can see the more involved you are, the better sorted you are. But it's still the case that even the strong Democrats, about a sixth of the population, strong Republicans, about an eighth of the population, are not as sorted as members of Congress. One out of five strong Democrats still is basically pro-life. They would allow abortion only in the most traumatic cases or never. And maybe even more surprisingly, one out of three strong Republicans is pro-choice. Now, you'd never get that from watching TV, and people basically don't advertise this. We know from other research that if you're in the minority position in your group, you don't advertise it. You just keep your mouth shut. The same is true on gun control, another issue that I've looked at. Now, the problem with developing these European-style parties in the United States is real simple. There's only two of them. That most democracies have multi-parties. If you're in the United States and you feel very strongly about gun rights, you have to vote for Republican, even if you disagree on every other issue. In France, you can vote for the Hunter's Party. You know, now, we don't necessarily need 17 parties, but nevertheless, more than we have. That the two parties bundle issues in a certain way, and if you don't bundle them in exactly that same way, which many Americans don't, you're going to be voting for a party that's wrong for you on at least one of the bundles. And the consequence is, do the parties represent your views reasonably well? Well, the strong partisans say, yeah, pretty much. The less strong partisans, not so much. The leaners, not so much. Independents, not at all. Support for a third party is at an all-time high, although there's not general agreement on what that party should look like. Just to mention the current issue, the electorate versus Republican positions. Basically, about 60% of the electorate opposes voting a wall. 60% or more think immigration helps the country. Vast majorities want to keep families together. Vast majorities want a path to citizenship for dreamers. And even majorities generally want a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants. On the other side, very few people want to increase immigration. A lot of people want to decrease it, at best hold it the same. A large majority generally, depending on question wording, would like to switch to skill-based immigration rather than family reunification. They do think the Mexican border is a real problem, and there is simply not majority support for abolishing ICE. I think Rob and I could go into a room and in an hour sketch out an omnibus that if there were a national referendum would get 60% of the vote. It would get virtually no votes in Congress. Republicans and Democrats would both oppose it for different reasons. So we have a party system that simply doesn't represent the views of the American public. Now, there's a lot of talk recently about, I'm talking here about public opinion. I'm saying there's public opinion really hasn't polarized. Some people have claimed that, okay, things are not happening at a cognitive level. They're happening at an emotional level, that people simply hate each other more now than they do. And I think there is some of that. Basically, if the average Democrat and the average Republican disagree on more issues, they're probably going to like each other less than in the past. I think that's sort of a natural human tendency. But notice that the proportion of partisans is at an all-time low since we've been measuring it. In the Eisenhower era, 3/4 of the public happy to say I'm a Democrat or Republican. Today, 40% of the public won't even cop to being a member of one of the two parties. And people increasingly dislike both parties. That these are ratings of Republican ratings of Democrats and vice versa, and it's steadily going down. But people don't even like their own party as much as they used to. And the go-to book here is a book by Samara Carr and Yana Krupnikov, just talking about ordinary people reacting against the whole notion of partisanship because they find today's partisanship unattractive. I think there are two tribes in America, but they're not the two parties. A couple years ago, a Berkeley and a Stanford graduate student got together and had one of my colleagues, Doug Rivers, run a poll where they investigated the stereotypes people have of the other party. And the results were almost unbelievable. For example, Republicans believed that, they estimated, that more than a third of Democrats are LGBT. The actual figure is probably about six. They estimated that more than a third of Democrats are godless. The actual figure is about nine. Democrats believe that nearly half of Republicans make more than $250K a year. The actual figure in the United States is 2% of the population makes $250K a year. And not quite as big a disparity, only 100%, they thought Republicans are all old senior citizens. Yeah. Now, where would they get ideas like this? Well, although Americans don't pay any attention to politics, I think what little they see, well, if you're walking through the airport or something on CNN, or you just happen to catch a flash of Fox News, the media sort of portrays, they say, get me a Democrat and get me a Republican. They have this image, they call it exemplification in the communications literature. And so they give this image that, oh, all Democrats look like this, or all Republicans look like this, when in fact most Democrats and Republicans look sort of similar. That's Ayler and Good, 2015. The general public contrasts with normal people. The general public, people are inattentive, they're confused about the issues, they're ambivalent, they're pro-choice and pro-life at the same time. And that's not a criticism. That's why we have representative democracy, that we're supposed to elect leaders who are full-time's job is to find out about the issues and become not confused. Ordinary people are uninvolved politically, and they're concerned with bread-and-butter issues. A lot of you here are members of the 1%. And unfortunately, I'm not talking about your incomes. I'm talking about the 1% of the population, the electorate, that subscribes to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. We have 235 million eligible voters. That's how many people subscribe to the major national newspapers. Hannity, the highest rated show on cable TV, gets about 1.5. Rachel Maddow's ratings have surged since the Trump election. She's a little over 1% now. Fox News, Democrats worry about that so much. Its daily audience is about 1%. Of the population. It's been, somebody quoted recently that CNN had almost as many panelists as viewers. And that's sort of true. They are about 0.4% of the American public tuned into CNN, Anderson Cooper, in any given night. And comparatively speaking, six times as many people watch Sunday Night Football as watch Meet the Press on Sunday morning, and Big Bang Theory is going off. About 10% of the population gives money to a campaign, any campaign, from school board all the way up to president. It hasn't changed in all these years, since 1952. People talk about all their small donors, but the fact of the matter is simply that it's the same people giving over and over and over again. There are studies like that. If you manned a telephone or knocked on doors, you're really unusual. That's been about 2 or 3% of the public all these years. So most Americans are uninvolved. They only basically come out to vote. One of the questions, obviously, is the internet changing everything? No. Facebook, down our way, did a big study a few years ago. They were interested in this idea of filter bubbles, ideological silos that people are locking themselves in and only getting news from ideologically compatible sources. Well, they tracked Bing toolbar users, millions of them, for 90 days, and they found that only 14% of them had clicked on 10 or more news articles in all that time, one every 9 days. Yeah. They had to sign these sites ideologically speaking, so they found, unfortunately for them, that only 4% had read more than one opinion column in 90 days. So Paul Krugman or George Will, et cetera, their audience is basically other columnists, that it's not Americans. Yeah. Twitter is a new big thing, and like most big things, it's exaggerated. Pew Research study last year found that less than 4% of adults say Twitter is an important source of news. And by the way, when people say news, they often mean things like Kim Kardashian, the weather, sports, et cetera, like that. Donald Trump talked about, he bragged he had 20 million followers, Twitter followers, during the campaign. Well, even if you take, these audiences are vastly inflated, but that's a paltry number compared to Katy Perry, who's the leader. Obama has this, Lady Gaga, Kim Kardashian. Pitbull, I had to Google that one. He's a rapper. And Trump had 17 million at the time. He's now up to 53, so he's half of Katy Perry here. So the internet is not changing anything. What the Facebook people found was not that people, the problem is not they're getting only ideologically biased news, it's they're getting no news. And that's sort of a long finding in American politics. So in sum, civil war is not imminent. The 2016 presidential election was over-exaggerated. The racism, sexism, et cetera, the voters was exaggerated. Americans simply felt they had lousy choices in 2016. And the Democrats' problem goes beyond the white working class. Now, I haven't talked about any of this stuff. That's in the half of the presentation I couldn't give. So if you want to get into that, I urge you to buy this book, Unstable Majorities. If you have a birthday or an anniversary coming up, this would be a very thoughtful gift. Yeah, and Dan, thank you.
Thanks, Mo. Our next panelist is Leah Stokes. Leah is a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Her research examines public policy, public opinion, and political behavior, and her substantive focus is on energy and environmental policy. So keep that in mind in the Q&A if you have burning questions about that. Her work has been published in top journals in our field, including the American Political Science Review and the American Journal of Political Science. And one thread of this work focuses on how political leaders understand or view the preferences of voters, and turns out how they, in some cases, at least misunderstand those preferences, and what effect that has on our system of representation. And that's the work that she's going to talk to us about today. So I will hand things off to Leah.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's very nice to be invited to give a talk today. So as Rob just mentioned, I'm going to present a paper that I worked on with some co-authors, which looked at, it really builds nicely on what Mo just talked about. What do political elites actually understand about what the public wants across a wide variety of issues? So the thing that I work on a lot is climate change policy. And the question that we run on regular surveys is, do Americans support regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant? And what you might not know is that we can use a tool which is widely used now in political science called multi-level regression with post-stratification, or MRP. And what this basically does is it allows us to create high-resolution estimates of what people want. So we can figure out in any given congressional district or county, or we can even go further down if we have a big enough sample size, we can figure out what people want on a given issue. And that's really nice because then we can compare that to what politicians are actually doing. So what do Americans want on climate change? Well, across every single congressional district in the United States, a majority of people support regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant. You may not know that, but that's been pretty stable for a long time. Of course, Congress is not doing that, but it would be very nice if they did. Now, you might say, well, sure, that's a majority in districts, but what about partisan divisions? Well, my colleagues at the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, as well as at UC Santa Barbara, have figured that out. They've downscaled Republican and Democratic preferences on climate action at the state level. And here's what it looks like. So on the left, we have Democrats, and you can see that Democrats really, really would like us to do something about the climate crisis. For those of you who live in the Bay Area, you may have recently experienced wildfires and really bad air quality, and that is caused by climate change. So, you know, maybe people are waking up to the reality that climate change is already happening. But what's amazing, and you might not know, is that actually majority of Republicans in vast majority of states also want Congress to act on climate change. So despite what is portrayed, particularly by fossil fuel interest groups, Republicans still would like action on climate change. So we see here that both partisan groups still want action at pretty much all the states. Okay, so we see that there's broad and consistent support for doing something about the climate crisis, and yet we don't see government action. So the last major bill to try to deal with climate change was in 2009, the Waxman-Markey bill. It got very close to passing in the Senate, but ultimately failed. So we don't really see much happening on climate change at the federal level. So how can we explain that? And the answer that I'm going to present to you today is from a paper that I co-authored, which shows that perhaps politicians and their staff don't actually know what the public wants. We spend a lot of time assuming in American politics that this representation link happens, where the public would like something, and then politicians know that and then try to do something about it. And in this paper, we show that that doesn't seem to hold. So the paper I'm going to present today came out earlier this year in the APSR with my co-authors Alex Hertel-Fernandez and Matt O'Mildenberger. And the result is basically that political staffers in Congress, this is chiefs of staff and legislative directors, the most senior members of a congressional staff who help their politicians decide how to vote on a bill, they do not know what the public wants across a wide variety of issue areas. And I'm going to show you that egocentric bias, which is the idea that staffers are substituting their own beliefs, like Mo was just telling you, these are more extreme people who are serving in these roles. They're substituting their own beliefs for the public's beliefs. And I'm going to show you that interest groups are playing an important role in distorting public opinion. There's supplementary work that we've been doing on this. We've interviewed a number of chiefs of staff and legislative directors in Congress, and we've already replicated these results at the state level with both politicians themselves as well as their staffers. So this is very robust. And I will also say it builds on work by David Brockman, who is here today, and his colleague Chris Scovrin. So what did we do? We fielded a survey in August 2016. So this is a time when an election is coming. You may recall what was occurring in 2016. And so you would think that staffers and politicians are really knowing what the public wants. They're about to run an election. They've got to sort of make the case to their publics. You know, what are they seeing in terms of what the public wants? Okay, so who did we survey? We surveyed chiefs of staff and legislative directors in Congress, and we did this for both the House and the Senate side. And the survey instrument asked a range of questions about what do staffers believe about different public preferences, what do they believe themselves about policy, what are some work practices, and we also embedded some experiments in this survey. How did we get people to answer our survey? Well, it turns out that many congressional offices have a policy against answering surveys, which is most unfortunate when it comes to a research perspective. But we partnered with the Legislative Branch Working Group, and there was a Democratic representative who's really into sort of research and understanding things better, and he helped us by sending out a Dear Colleague letter. And so we actually got a decent response rate, which is on the order of what official surveys of Congress get. So it's really hard to get this population to respond to surveys, but we still did a decent job. So if you're a political scientist, you're going to worry about balance tables. What does that mean? Well, we want the people who answer our survey to look like the population at large. So we wouldn't just want, you know, completely lefty liberal staffers to answer our survey or, you know, Tea Party staffers to answer our survey. We want kind of a range. And what this basically shows you is, because most of these confidence intervals cross that dotted line, is that we get pretty good balance. So this is probably representative of staffers in Congress more broadly. Okay, so we ask staffers, what matters when you are helping your member decide how to vote on a bill? Okay, so there's a big bill coming up in Congress. How are they going to vote? You're going to help them make that decision. You're a chief of staff. And guess what they told us? They said the public opinion of constituents is the most important thing. That's the thing that's top of mind, as well as communication from constituents, okay? And look, this is a bipartisan view. Democrats and Republicans are saying that. And you can see that other things break down along the partisan lines we might expect. So businesses, for example, are more important to Republican staffers advising their members than Democrats, and similarly unions, much more important to Democrats than Republicans. So this kind of makes sense intuitively and squares with how we sort of think democracy works. So let's find out if they actually know what the public would like on a wide variety of issues. So what are we going to do? We're going to first ask these staffers, what do you think the public wants, okay? And they're going to tell us across a bunch of different policy domains. And then we're going to estimate what the public actually wants using this very well-validated technique that I won't get into, but basically we can create a very accurate estimate at a fine geographic scale, like a congressional district or a state, of what the public wants. Okay, so let's say that staffers knew what the public wanted on an issue. This is what the picture would look like, okay? So this is not real data, it's fake data, but what you can see here is that as true district support goes up, right, so people move up, in terms of supporting carbon regulation, so does the staffer's estimate. So it's falling on this 45-degree line. We'd say that's like a high correlation, okay? So that should be the reference, that if the staffers knew what the public wanted, that's what the picture should look like, okay? This is what the picture actually looks like. So in other words, staffers do not know what the public wants. And what you can see here is that Republicans are dramatically underestimating support for acting on climate. So whenever we see dots falling to the left-hand side of the 45-degree line, that's an underestimation. And when it falls to the right, that's an overestimation. So look, there's even a ton of Democrats who are underestimating public support for climate change action. And what's interesting here, to go back to what Mo was talking about, is if you just look at the range of these dots, what that's basically showing you is the variance in terms of what different districts want on climate change. And you can see here that sometimes when I present this to political scientists, they're like, what? There's so little variation at the state or the congressional district level in what the public wants on a wide variety of policy domains. And as Mo just pointed out, yes, that is true. There is not a lot of variation. So most people recognize the climate crisis is real and that perhaps we should do something about it. So we didn't just do this on climate change. We did this on five different issue areas. And what you can see here is that the pattern holds across the board. Gun control, specifically a background check for selling guns, is a very popular policy idea. And this is not a topic that I work a lot on, but I taught a public policy class many years ago and had to teach a couple classes on gun control. And so I read a few things, and I learned doing that the vast majority of the public supports background check for guns. So this is the kind of fact that a staffer could learn very quickly if they spent, you know, a couple hours reading anything about gun sales. So, because look, it's even Republican districts are supporting this in something like 75% and above. Okay? So that's what we find. Now, you might say, well, it's because they're estimating partisans. I already showed you those maps at the beginning that even Republicans support action on climate change. And so we can use those downscaled estimates from that other paper and show you that, no, they're not just estimating co-partisans. So, for example, if Democrats were just thinking about what other Democrats want and ignoring their constituency who are Republicans in their district, they would still be underestimating support dramatically. And the same goes for Republicans. We replicated this across a wide variety of policy domains at the state level. And the cool thing about the state paper, much like David Brockman's work, is that it works with politicians and their staff. So it's not just staffers who are ignorant. It's also politicians who are ignorant about what the public wants. And we show this for things like legalizing Dreamers, the $12 minimum wage, lots of different issue areas. Okay, so why should staffers know this thing? I've already given you a sense that it's not that hard to find out. If you read a single Paul Krugman or other op-ed columnist one point in your life, you would probably learn these facts. Public opinion is in the media a lot. But in addition, the offices spend a lot of time doing this. So when they told us on the survey that contact from constituents is really important, that public opinion is really important, that isn't just cheap talk. It's how the offices function. So it turns out that offices use this software that's provided by a bunch of different providers, and they use it to record and compile every single piece of information that they get from their constituents. So if you write a postcard or a letter, it gets entered into a database, okay? And in fact, what they do is they print out on a given issue before they're going to vote on an issue. Let's say there's a vote on background checks for guns or an assault weapon ban or something like that. They go into their database and they print out everything they've gotten from their constituents and they say, okay, we've gotten this yays and these nays. They also use a lot of other ways to gauge public opinion. And even at the state level, where I don't know if you know very much about state politics, but it's not as professionalized across a lot of states, meaning they don't have as many staff. Some offices have no staff. And yet still 52% of offices are using this software. So they're spending a lot of time trying to figure out what the public wants. And I'll also say, for example, Pew, that does a lot of research on public opinion about gun control, it's not just a contact rate difference. So it's not just gun owners are out contacting non-gun owners. They do that, but it's not enough to explain the gap that we're seeing. Okay, so what does explain the gap? So we went through four hypotheses in our paper, and the two things that really were shown by the evidence was the staffer's own preferences, so this egocentric bias idea. Basically, they're saying, if I like something, I'm going to just assume the public likes it too. And as well as interest group contact. That seems to be very important. Okay, so what this shows is that we basically divide our data into when staffers agree with a statement or staffers disagree with a statement, and we look at do they make different kinds of estimates about what the public wants. And what you can say here is that for climate regulation, people who agree that we should do something about climate change, you see that they pretty much get it right. They're about hitting this zero line, okay? And people who personally disagree with acting on climate get it wrong by an average of 30 percentage points, okay? That's a dramatic underestimation of public support. And you see this across all the different policy domains. So if a person themselves thinks we should have background checks for guns, they get it a lot closer than somebody who does not think we should do that. So in other words, staffers are substituting their own beliefs for the public's beliefs. The second really important thing is interest groups. Interest groups play a very important role in the climate domain. And what you can see here is that the more money that offices are getting from corporate donors like the American Petroleum Institute, other fossil fuel companies like, let's say, ExxonMobil, the worse they get at guessing what the public wants. And the more they get relatively from sort of environmental groups, which, as you can see, they don't get much from environmental groups because the axis ends at zero. So, but you can see they get it a lot better when they're getting less money from fossil fuel companies. So this suggests that the money that fossil fuel companies have spent, which is on the order of billions globally to try to deny the science of climate change, has made a really big difference in terms of what politicians and their staff think about what the public wants on climate change. We do this across all our issue domains, and what you can see is that we ask them, who are you meeting with? Do you meet with the American Petroleum Institute? Do you meet with the National Rifle Association? Who are you meeting with? And they just tell us on the survey, and then we use that self-reported contact, and we plot it against their gaps in knowledge. And what you can see is the more they're meeting with these corporate groups, the worse they get at guessing what the public wants. The more they're meeting with sort of mass-based groups, the better they get. And the same goes for corporate contributions. Now, if you're a political scientist or perhaps somebody who's been trained in econometrics, you say, yes, these are correlations. What have you really shown me? Well, we also ran experiments as part of this survey, and I won't talk about them too much, but one of them we ran at the federal level, and it's called the List Experiment. What that basically does is it allows us to elicit sort of sensitive items. So it allows us to show that if people don't want to say that they changed their minds because of getting money from corporate groups, we can get them to kind of say that in a sensitive way. And what do we find? 45% of staffers say that they have changed their mind about a public policy issue after meeting with a campaign contributor. In other words, campaign contributions seem to be changing what politicians and their staff think should be done. The last thing to say is, how do they find out about what the public wants? Well, they're not really using public opinion polls. They're mostly relying on in-person meetings. So these interest groups who come to the office and have a meeting, they're really the ones who have the ears of these offices. So in conclusion, legislators and staffers don't know what the public wants across a wide variety of issue areas. In my book project that I'm finishing, I show that interest groups really play a very strong role in constructing public opinion for politicians. And so we often sort of think about public opinion as a fact out there in the world that's seeable. But interest groups are kind of a block or a shield between the public opinion and politicians. And as a result, we have groups like fossil fuel corporations really distorting the public's preferences on things like climate change. Okay, thank you so much.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
Okay, so our last panelist for this panel is going to be Jessica Traunstein. Jessica is a professor of political science at UC Merced. Her work, which includes two books and numerous articles, focuses on urban politics and representation. Her most recent book is titled Segregation by Design, Local Politics and Inequality in American Cities. This work draws on more than 100 years of quantitative and qualitative data from thousands of American cities to explore how local governments have used their power to control land use and segregate people and provide them with very different levels of government services and amenities. Today, she's going to talk to us about the more general issue of actual segregation and how it contributes to political polarization. So actual geographic segregation, how it contributes to political polarization. So I'll give you Jessica.
Thanks so much for being here and for inviting me to come talk to you today about the geography of polarization. So a lot of what I'm going to talk to you about is drawn from this book that Rob mentioned, Segregation by Design. So Mo and Leah both talked about elites and how we shouldn't be so worried about polarization in the general public. I'm going to offer a little bit of a different take here. I'm going to try to show you that that the geographic level at which we measure polarization really matters. And when we get down to the neighborhood level, we are, in fact, polarized. The geographic distribution of residents plays a powerful role in the divisions of American politics. And it's a pattern that can be traced back many decades. And I'm going to go back, not as far as my book does, goes back to the 1890s. I'm just going to go back to the 1970s today. By World War II, the United States was already a very segregated nation. All large cities in the United States had clearly defined racial enclaves. And this is a picture of Camden, New Jersey, in 1940. And you can see that Camden was a very segregated city. This might not surprise you if you know anything about Camden or New Jersey, but all cities in the United States had this basic pattern. And what you can see here is that there are neighborhoods where there are clusters of African-American residents and other neighborhoods in the same city that are almost completely white. This kind of segregation, I'm going to call this neighborhood-level segregation, peaked in 1970 and then dropped rather dramatically over the next several decades. In the post-war period, another demographic transformation was underway. Suburban populations were exploding. Rising incomes, low-cost federally backed mortgages, the lucrative federal mortgage deduction, new housing construction in suburban tracts, and an extensive network of highways all worked to pull people to the periphery. Yet during this period, as a result of federal, state, and local policies, as well as discriminatory behavior among white residents, real estate agents, and mortgage lenders, suburban living was nearly exclusively available to white homeowners. What this means is that we transformed from a nation segregated by neighborhood to one that has been ever more segregated city to city. And here you can see in 1970, Camden, I'm going to try to point at this and see if I do it okay. Camden, here on the left, has become nearly all African American. And Cherry Hill, this neighboring little suburb here, is nearly all white. These patterns continue to pull our residents apart. Here we are in 2011, and you can see that Camden has basically become all black, and Cherry Hill, while it's diversified a little bit, is still much whiter than its neighboring Camden. Residents in places like Cherry Hill came to expect low taxes. They rationalized this pattern of racial segregation and inequality as the product of meritocracy, and they conflated white exclusivity with high property values. They couched demands from their city government and their national government in terms of the protection of their individual property rights. And that trend and that pattern in the way in which people analyze their own place that they live and what they ask of their government has continued today. Suburban populations have diversified, particularly in the suburbs closest to the central cities. Urbanists call these the inner ring suburbs. But you can see across the United States, these are data from 2011, that suburbs, I'm going to go back. That was an exciting picture. Suburbs are much whiter than the central cities that they surround. So suburbs are on average 73% white relative to 58% white in central cities. And these figures have grown more dramatic over time. So you can see that suburbs are whiter, they are wealthier, and they are much more likely to have high rates of home ownership. These things matter for politics. Political geography is comprised of nested units, right? Think about who represents you. Neighborhoods are nested within districts. Districts are nested within cities. Cities within states and states within the nation. When residential geography maps onto political geography, political divisions become fused with race and class divisions. And this has important consequences. First, segregation creates inequalities between race and class groups. Because in a world of scarce resources, the politically powerful deny public benefits to those who are politically weak. Segregation across city lines has meant that the benefits experienced by racial and ethnic minorities and low-income individuals are inferior to the public benefits that are experienced by white and wealthy residents. Second, and this is mostly what I'm going to talk about, segregation generates political polarization between communities. One of the difficult aspects of studying segregation is trying to figure out exactly how to measure it, and there are lots and lots of different ways to measure it. One way to think about segregation is to quantify how each neighborhood differs from the larger community of which it is a part. So you can think about each neighborhood, how each neighborhood differs from the larger metropolitan area that it is situated in. Some neighborhoods will be whiter than the metropolitan area is generally, and others will be less white. So this variable, this is the way that I'm going to measure segregation for today, and I'm going to call it the tracked metropolitan difference in percent white residents, is going to do most of the work in my analysis here. I measure this in 1970 for the rest of my talk because, as I said before, 1970 was the high point of segregation in the United States. And I argue in my book that 1970 represents a particular moment in American history where neighborhoods adopted particular perspectives and personalities that became sticky and have persisted over time. Generally, I'm going to expect that neighborhoods that are whiter than the metropolitan area as of 1970 are going to be more conservative than those that are less white. So here's Berkeley, the Berkeley metropolitan area, as of 2011. So these data, I can measure these data for any decade for which we have census data. And you can see the darker areas are places that are have more populations of people of color than the metropolitan area as a whole, and the lighter colors are places where there are fewer people of color. I begin by measuring the relationship between this segregation measure and presidential votes. I aggregated the Democratic share of the two-party presidential vote in 2008, and this figure plots the effect of my estimation, regressing 1970 relative whiteness on presidential votes in 2008. This big, steep line shows you that places that were relatively whiter in 1970 were much, much less likely to vote for Obama in 2008. In fact, they were about 42 percentage points less likely to support Obama relative to places that had more people of color in 1970. But of course, you're sitting there thinking, well, duh, Jessica, white people live in white neighborhoods, and we already know that white people are more likely to vote Republican. But I want to suggest to you that these neighborhood effects persist even when we account for the individual traits of the people that live in these places. So what I'm trying to argue here is that the place has a personality and a political personality that is a driver of polarization in American politics. But to see this, I need individual level survey data, which at the local level is very, very hard to come by. So I use a series of strategies where I compile data over a long period of time, from 1998 to 2008. And I'm going to show you an annoying data table here. Here's the annoying data table. What I want to point out is this top line. This tracked metropolitan difference in the percentage of the residents that were white in 1970 in a particular neighborhood. And you can see that these numbers are positive and they're strong. And this is accounting for all of the individual level observation, all of the pieces of individual level information that I might have about any one respondent. And this map, this table, is only showing you white respondents. If I added people of color to my table, you would see even more dramatic results. In every case, we see a strong positive relationship between the demographics of that neighborhood in 1970 and the political attitudes of the people who live there today. Places that were whiter than the metropolitan area as of 1970 are home to significantly more Republican and conservative residents today. And this is the case even when we account for both individual and aggregate demographic traits that predict partisanship and ideology. Perhaps unsurprisingly, neighborhood whiteness is also powerfully related to attitudes toward minorities, prejudice, and racially targeted policies. This slide shows the correlation between a respondent's 1970 neighborhood demographics and the respondent's feelings about a close relative marrying a black person and preferences for white neighbors. And you can see in both pictures that as we have whiter neighborhoods, you are more likely to prefer whiter neighbors and also to oppose a relative marrying a black person. Clearly, the respondents of these surveys who live in whiter neighborhoods are more opposed to close interracial contact. Respondents who live in whiter neighborhoods are also likely to see persistent black inequality as being the result not of discrimination or unequal opportunities. So we can see that the differences here, you can see that as we get whiter, people are less likely to believe that African Americans experience significant discrimination, and they are less likely to believe that they experience a lack of educational opportunity. So living in a whiter neighborhood leads to different perspectives about what the underlying causes of inequality are in American society. Finally, I find that residents of neighborhoods that were whiter than the metropolitan area as of 1970 are more opposed to affirmative action and more likely to oppose open housing laws. And I want to point out this second picture in particular here, the opposition to open housing laws. In most of the book, this is what I spend my time talking about. The propensity for suburban communities to create land use regulation that prohibits the integration of communities is a major driver of these processes. And so this is the most recent question that we had asking about open housing laws was in about 2006. And you can see that even still, people who live in neighborhoods that were whiter as of 1970 are more likely to oppose open housing laws. And those are laws that permit the development of any kind of housing and permit the sale of housing to any person who is a willing buyer. In sum, I think we have a great deal of evidence that residential segregation is a fundamental contributor to partisan and ideological polarization. And the political results of this residential clustering are powerful. Segregation generates inequality in access to public goods. White, wealthy communities garner a disproportionate share of government benefits. And second, elected officials, attentive to their homogeneous communities, have little incentive to compromise or coordinate to address these inequalities. The answer is not to do nothing or to ignore these divisions. The argument that I make in the book is it's instead to promote integration of our geographies, and that integration of our geographies will ultimately create a more balanced public and a less polarized community.
Great presentations. Thank you very much. Just a quick question for the first presenter, for Morris. A great analysis. What was in my mind was one factor that you didn't talk about that I was hoping you would talk about is the role of money in politics. You talked about the role of the media, and you showed us the trends. What is the impact of money? And it came out in the second talk of interest groups and access to these politicians through donations. How has that impacted the separation that you showed?
Well, it's studies clearly show that donors are ideological. They're more polarized in the public, small donors as well as large donors. So they would be part of that whole group of political elites that are sort of driving public officials in a more extreme direction. On the role of money generally, where's Brockman? I was going to punt it off to him in the audience. Okay. The role of money generally, I think a lot of political scientists don't think it's as important as a lot of people in the media do. For one thing, the system is just awash in money. And, I mean, Donald Trump got badly outspent in the last election, at least in terms, well, we don't know the dark money necessarily. But there's just so much diminishing returns. They spend so much that I can't believe an extra 100 ads in the last week in Ohio was going to make much difference. They've already run 1,000. But I do think that simply anybody who is an activist, who is a donor, a worker, et cetera, has a disproportionate influence, and they help to drive the politicians to more extreme places. And they sort of contribute to this inaccuracy of perceptions of what people are really like.
I mean, Josh Kalla and David Brockman have a fantastic paper which shows that campaign contributions facilitate access, and that really syncs up with the paper that I showed you, which is that if you give money, you can get access more easily, and then when you get access, you can change opinions and influence politicians and their staff. So it does appear from some recent research that money does make a difference in terms of gaining access. And from the paper I showed you, once you gain access, you can also change minds.
Yeah, I was wondering for all three presenters, particularly the first two, you measured public opinion, but you didn't talk much about the strength of an individual's views. So in other words, like someone who's a member of the NRA may be a single issue voter, whereas others aren't. And so I was wondering about that factor, and the other part would be the if there's a disconnect between what a politician believes and what their voters believe, why hasn't there been a consequential electoral consequence?
So we call that salience, and I think salience is a challenge. What I did mention in the talk was that if you look at, for example, Pew's research on gun owners and non-gun owners and how much they contact Congress, you can see that, yes, gun owners contact disproportionately, so Congress is hearing more from gun owners than non-gun owners, and that's kind of a proxy for salience. But it's not enough to reverse the signal is what I'm saying. So if 90% of people support background checks from guns, there aren't enough gun owners saying don't do that to swamp the majority of people contacting Congress saying we would like background checks for guns. So at least for that issue, which is the one I've seen the data on, it doesn't seem that salience can explain it in this particular case. In terms of why our electoral system is broken, I don't know if I necessarily have a comprehensive answer to that. One answer that Mo gave was that the parties aren't really providing bundles of packages that the public necessarily wants. So there's not really an exit option. Who are you going to vote for alternatively, right? So I also feel that the primary system is an important thing that's driving some of this polarization where you have donors and activists and some of the more extreme people, including interest groups, playing significantly in the primaries and bringing different kinds of people into Congress or even just threatening to primary people and therefore driving them. And so who you actually get to choose at the end of the day becomes more extreme. And so the entire system ends up being such that it's pretty hard to sort of throw people out at the end of the day if you don't like them.
When I was an undergraduate well over a half century ago, the first political science course I took, we debated something called the intensity problem in democratic theory, small d democratic. And the question was, if you have a really intense minority, should that minority, facing an apathetic majority, who should prevail? And there were political philosophers who argued, in that case, it's probably better the intense minority should prevail. And certainly politicians sort of behave that way. They don't just count votes, they weigh votes, and they say who is going to actually be out there in the primary elections. And I think the single issue voters make the following kind of contribution to the nationalization of our elections. It's been pointed out that people just don't split their tickets much anymore. It goes all the way down to the state legislative level, for example. And part of the reason is just basically every Democrat from the top to bottom looks the same practically, and every Republican looks the same. They aren't as different as they used to be. And one of the possible explanations is you look at the primary electorates, it's going to be on the Republican side, the gun groups, the pro-life groups, the taxpayer groups. Democratic side, it's the public employees, it's the environmental groups. So it's the same sort of intense voters in the primary constituencies no matter where you are in the country. And I think that has really contributed to sort of the whole nationalization of the electoral system that we have today.
But not at the local level. There's almost no map of national partisan polarization onto local political issues.
I wanted to direct my question to Professor Traunstein in the question that with the within neighborhoods, what would your response to the rise of gentrification in minority communities, how would you be able to measure that? Because typically those populations that are moving into minority communities are of a liberal wing, especially in cities like, as jokingly mentioned in the first talk, like hipsters of Oakland and things like that, disproportionately displacing communities of minorities and people of color.
So
So the first thing to say is that gentrification is not the predominant movement of people in America these days. So we are still hollowing out. People are still moving to the peripheries of communities and still moving to the suburbs. We do have some movement back to the center cities in some select metropolitan areas, but that's not the general pattern across the United States. What happens when you have a community that gentrifies is essentially you have people that are willing to move back into a location, and they're willing to trade something that maybe their parents or their grandparents weren't willing to trade, right? So you see gentrifiers moving back into center cities who maybe don't care about the public schools or are willing to send their children to private schools when it comes time to send their kids to schools. That breaking of the link between public services and where people live is part of what drives gentrification. And so a lot of this matters sort of where we build housing and how we make decisions about how we're going to integrate. So that wasn't a direct answer to your question, but generally speaking, gentrification is not the predominant pattern of how people are moving in America today.
So I'm going to ask you maybe a somewhat related question when you're talking about the urban geography. So if we did the changes in geography and polarization and changed land use rules and access, if we changed those things and communities began to look different, what would happen to the political views of the people living in those communities?
This is an interesting sort of experimental question, right? If only I could become a deity and just randomly assign people to live in different places, that would be wonderful. So there's two things to say. One is that even if nobody changed their perspectives, the political representation would still change. And here's the way to think about this. When we have the old picture of Camden, right, where there are very white neighborhoods and very black neighborhoods, Camden is still represented by the same one member of Congress at that time, right? And so that member of Congress has to pay attention to both the white neighborhoods and the black neighborhoods in order to get reelected. Fast forward to a time when Camden is all black and Cherry Hill is all white, and Camden is represented by that one member of Congress. That one member of Congress pays attention to black Camden, and the one member of Congress who represents Cherry Hill pays attention to white Cherry Hill. That creates more division in the political system. So when you have more integrated communities, even if everybody kept their same viewpoints, our political system would be more integrated. And we can see that over time in the history of representation. And you can see it at the local level and at the state level. I haven't done work at the national level, so I'll just make that up and say that we probably see it there too. But the other thing to say is that I argue in the book, and I tried to make a little bit of that argument here today, that neighborhoods actually change people's perspectives. And it's hard to measure this. It's hard to define this. But we know from some work done by some really terrific scholars at Stanford that buying a home, for instance, changes your calculation of what you do in the political system, how you vote on bond elections, who you vote for in local politics. And so if we imagine that the place in which you live shapes your viewpoints, that more integrated communities potentially could shape people's viewpoints in different ways. But we don't have a really good way to measure that or to figure out what exactly that would look like.
Yes, in Novato in Marin County, the city has decided that it's going to change from at-large election of the city council to district elections of the city council in response to a lawsuit that's going on that apparently you know about, following a civil rights legislation indicating that somehow the district system is fairer to minorities. And I'm wondering, because that would take the influence of the minorities completely away from what goes on in the center of the city. And it just seems to me that there may be some unanticipated consequences to that assumption, and I wonder what you think about
that. Can you say more about that second piece of your statement there? I'll address your whole question in just a minute. But you said something about the center city.
Yeah, the center of the city is where the fun is, where the commercial stuff is mostly there, mm-hmm. the restaurants, the real tenor of the city mm-hmm. seems to be mostly what happens in the center of the city. And the city council spends much of its time, of course, on that. Mm-hmm. And all of the members of the city council have really a more or less equal influence on that. Now, the Latinos mostly are the minority in our area, and they're mostly in certain neighborhoods, although that's fortunately only mostly now. And if they have in effect one member of the city council, and that city and their interest, that person's interest is only in that part of the city, pretty much, that does distort things. And I was just wondering if any thought has been given to whether that might actually be to the disadvantage of minorities in certain circumstances to have their own representative like that.
So there's lots of ways to answer this question. So the first thing to say is that because of the California Voting Rights Act, the California's version of the Voting Rights Act, it is much easier for it's much easier to sue cities if they are if they have an election system that appears to disadvantage racial and ethnic minorities. And so Novato is part of a big sea change in California. This is happening all over California. The data indicate that there is absolutely a very powerful correlation between electing people of color to city councils and having districted elections. So that's been true since. So at-large elections were invented in the early 1900s as a way to kick blacks off of the city council in Reconstruction cities. So there was that was purposeful. It became a broader phenomenon. And most cities in California and most reformed cities throughout the United States had at-large councils. So there's a very strong relationship between electing people at the district level and having representatives of color on your city council. The question that you're asking is, whose interests are better represented by one type of city council or another? And a little bit that depends on who you think interests, you know, what your interests are and whether or not you share those interests with other people in the city. So we do know that when you have a districted council, that the council tends to have more neighborhood-oriented views. And this is, I think, part of what you're getting at here, right? So if we know that when you have at-large elections, that there tends to be a more citywide focus of the kinds of policies that the city council enacts. What may be best for the city as a whole may not be good for any individual neighborhood. And so, again, you are going to, anytime you make a decision that is to, say, increase the economic development by putting a new highway through the city, and you have to raise a neighborhood in order to put that highway through the city, the neighborhood that gets raised doesn't feel so good about that citywide decision, right? And so moving to districts would prevent that neighborhood from getting raised, potentially, but it might also prevent the city from getting the highway. So, you know, these are trade-offs that we have to make in politics. And yes, political science and local politics scholars spend a lot of time trying to understand what those trade-offs look like. Generally speaking, we see that neighborhood concerns are better represented in districted systems. Whether or not you think that's a normatively good thing is a matter for debate.
This is a similar question that arises in the case of majority-minority districts in Congress, that you can clearly elect more minorities if you select majority-minority districts, but you get fewer Democrats. And so you have to trade off the idea of virtual representation versus policy representation.
I just wanted to add that I have a student, Chris Miljanich. He's a graduate of this department from his undergrad, and he has written a paper which tests actually this exact thing. He's called up all the different cities in California to figure out when they switched from district to at-large or vice versa, and he has shown that it increases minority representation by 8 percentage points, which actually makes it more descriptively represented by about 20 percentage points. So it is serving to undo the previous move when you move to at-large elections, and it is serving to increase descriptive representation by bringing more minorities onto city councils. And he's doing this in sort of a causally identified way.
But it's an important point, right? So eight percentage point increase would be about a seat on a city council on average in California. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is you have potentially one minority voice against six non-minority voices, right? Six white voices. And so, again, I think getting back to your question and Mo's point here is, if that individual is unable to create a coalition on the city council, they're very unlikely to make any headway in terms of policy. So they're you know, it a little bit of this depends on sort of who the other members of the city council are and what kinds of policies they seek to enact.
I have a question, because I have the microphone. there's much talk about the base and how unwavering they are. This may be a silly question, but it's been implied that they're not really representative of the general public, yet politicians seem to worry disproportionately about offending this group. And I'm wondering, why is this? And do politicians really worry about this, quote, amorphous thing called the base?
I mean, 30, 40 years ago, the conventional wisdom was politicians should run to the center in an election, go for the median voter. And somewhere around the late 90s, early 2000s, it switched to you rally the base. And part of the explanation for that was simply there wasn't any median voter anymore. There weren't very many people there. Now, that's false, I think. But nevertheless, that is the prevailing wisdom now as you mobilize your base. What's really funny is there are a number of papers which suggest that the description of the base isn't that different from the party as a whole. That it's sort of contradictory that if you actually look at their views, that the Democratic primary voters, you know, don't differ that much from the regular Democratic voters. And I'm not sure how to explain it. One possibility is getting back to this whole question of single-issue voters. Maybe it's the whole intensity thing. Maybe the primary base is people who only care about choice, only care about global warming, only care about guns, et cetera. That maybe that's, and so when you mix them up with everybody else, they don't look different, but there's one issue that's really driving them, and they're really extreme on that issue. But otherwise, I think they think there is room for research here. If there's any young graduate students in the crowd, I think there's an open question here to look at.
And there are also interest groups, right? It's not just everyday people. There are vested groups who profit off of doing certain things, selling guns, polluting the air, et cetera, and they also play in primaries and other sort of base parts of politics.
I'm wondering about a question for the whole panel. What's your view of eliminating the Electoral College do in getting the public more involved in having their voice be heard?
Leah says she's Canadian, so she can't answer.
I don't get to vote anyway. Mo?
I get asked this question, sort of getting rid of the Senate, et cetera, and my answer is always, I won't speculate about things that aren't going to happen. You know, basically, as a political scientist, it's just not going to happen. So I'm not wasting my time on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think that, you know, people trying to bring representation more in line with sort of one person, one vote, whether that's, you know, statehood or some other representation for D.C. or Puerto Rico or other sort of colony-like parts of the United States, you know, I can understand those points of view. And that could extend towards the Electoral College, but I think, like Mo says, it's very hard to do that in practice. But there are reasons why people want to have changes like that, because not everybody can vote.
Well, yeah, if I were czar, I'd say we should go by district, assign votes by district at the minimum. But the point is there are certain states that have real incentives not to do that.
Yes,
and it's
just
there's the problem with most reforms is they're going to screw somebody, and those people are going to oppose.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Handed me a mic, Rob, so... question first, initially for Mo, but for everybody. So Mo, I love your work. It's because I find it like a warm bath. It reassures me that all hope is not lost. I'm kind of a congenital optimist, I want to agree for some other reasons. But two things. One is just as a quick placeholder, I've never been quite satisfied with the way you play out the way the polarization of the parties has changed in Congress. And I've actually had this argument with Norm Ornstein and Tom Mann, who I know a lot better. Mm-hmm. I've never done the heavy lifting, though, to try and assemble some data to not to contradict it, but to controvert it to some extent. So leave that aside and narrow in on one aspect of it that jumped out at me from your presentation this morning. You mentioned that 1976 was the first time the two parties started to polarize and take distinct positions on abortion. And the first thing I think of is, well, that's the first election we had since the issue was nationalized by the Supreme Court. You know, before then, it was on a state-by-state basis. Mm-hmm. And the politics of it, which actually were confused in 76, yeah. A lot of people thought Jimmy Carter was pro-life and mm-hmm. Betty Ford was pro-choice, mm-hmm. and probably Jerry Ford too, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, in California in 67, you have a very liberal abortion law promoted largely by Republicans, signed by Ronald Reagan, most stoutly opposed by a liberal Democrat, the legendary John Vasconcelos. So I understand why, the good old days of the 50s when you say more people said they're Democrats, they could be very opposite people who'd say that. Southern segregationist and Northern integrationist. Both say, I'm a Democrat. When you nationalize things, and good reason to nationalize issues, civil rights being preeminent, that's when it starts to, you know, we start to sort these things out. So, sorry, I'm too on too long. Is there anybody who's tried to do an empirical analysis that connects the way we've nationalized so many controversial culture issues like abortion, like same-sex marriage and LGBT issues today, and the way the polarization has taken place?
I can't recall any good empirical analysis. I mean, the one book that really addresses this is Marianne Glendon's Rights Talk, where she talks about when you make, so say, abortion constitutional rights, suddenly it becomes a national issue and the sides divide up. Eric, can you think of...
There's a book by Stimson called Tides of Consent, looks exactly at the sorting on abortion. It's a short little book. It's a little skinny book. You can read it. But he talks exactly about sorting on this issue, and it goes to what Mo was talking about. So, yes, initially, when you have a new issue and it comes onto the stage, you have partisans on both sides of the issue, and people are basically not sorted, and then individuals take statements about it, and then groups start to sort over time into the two different camps. So it's a very nice book if you want to read about that.
I actually think we have run out of time for this panel now, so that will have to serve as our last question. But I welcome you to stay for lunch. They're going to open up and serve us lunch in the next few minutes here, and people are welcome to stay for that. And that should give you an opportunity, if you want to come talk to the panelists or continue discussions about the subject of this panel. So that's it for this panel today, and thank you very much to our panelists.
Great.